Thanks, Brother Scott, for that reading.
Now we look forward to the words of our Brother Bruce as he introduces the second study to us. Where is Yahweh, God of Elijah? Brother Bruce.
Thanks, Brother David. Beloved brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, have you ever been in a situation where you're holding a conversation with somebody and there's an elephant in the room? And by that, I mean there is this enormously large and difficult and sensitive issue that both of you are aware of, but neither of you is discussing. And it's a bizarre situation. You're discussing everything else calmly and in a matter-of-fact way, and you talk about the weather and, you know, whatever. But both of you are dancing around the elephant in the room, because it's just too difficult, too sensitive, too contentious, too whatever for both of you to engage your minds in. Well, brethren and sisters, in 2 Kings chapter 2, there is an elephant in the room. And Elijah and Elisha could not discuss this issue. What is the issue? Both of them, both Elijah and Elisha, knew that this was the day. The 10-year apprenticeship that Elisha had with Elijah was now over. And Elijah was going to be removed. And brethren and sisters, that pained Elisha. And I'll tell you something else. I'm sure it pained Elijah. You know, one of the grandest things, and not much is said in Scripture about this, we've got to sort of read it between the lines, but it's there. What did we see in our last session that characterized Elijah? Aloofness. Exclusivity. I only am left. Really? Is that right, Elijah? Are you sure of that? I've got 7,000. That haven't bent the knee to Baal. You're not aware of that? What about Obadiah, the man who came and saw you? He's left and he was a righteous man. What about Elisha? See, I don't think Elijah was making it up. I think he genuinely believed that he alone was the one who had the truth and no one else. He had so removed himself from Israel that he was totally out of touch, not only with Israel, but more particularly, brethren and sisters, with the ecclesia within Israel. And it was there, only it was underground. And Elijah was aloof, extreme, at the edges, and was completely unaware of that group of people. In fact, that group that had been established by Samuel so many years ago, called the Sons of the Prophets. Now, fast track 10 years. You got Elijah and Elisha, and there's an overlap. There's an apprenticeship. And Elijah was going to impart a large part of his spirit and the way he did things to Elisha, and for good reasons. This is not all one way. Elisha came from a fairly refined, fairly, organised sort of environment. He didn't come from that rusty, craggy, sort of rough place that Elijah had come from. And in a sense, brethren and sisters, he had to learn something of that spirit of Elijah. But Elijah had to learn something of the spirit of Elisha. And this cross-pollination of 10 years was to their mutual advantage. Now, brethren and sisters, we hinted at this on our last session. Let's just briefly mention it again. Look, there are times, you've done it, I've done it, where in the ecclesia of God, you can't for the life of you understand why God has put together in the one place yourself and brother so-and-so. He's the brother you don't get along with. He's the brother when you pull left, he pulls right. He's the brother when you say up, he goes down. And you come home and you tear your hair out and you say to your wife, look, you know, I think we're going to have to leave the ecclesia and go somewhere. And away it goes. And you just can't get it with him. Well, who would have put Elijah and Elisha together, brethren and sisters, for 10 years? 10 years, that's a prison sentence. And you know, at the end of that 10 years, what do we find about Elijah, firstly? What do we find? Well, he's the head of the ecclesia. What is 2 Kings chapter 2 all about if it isn't the sons of the prophets dotted in various places across Israel, representing the various ecclesias, a light stench, small, flickering, but it's still there. What is it but that Elijah is the head of the ecclesias and respected and part of it and warmly received? What a makeover that was for Elijah. I think he learnt what it was like to serve others and not always be judging and condemning and finding fault, which we so want to do, brothers and sisters. And Elijah learnt so much, and Elisha did too. And Elisha breaks down. He weeps at the loss of Elijah. As difficult as it may appear, two brethren, opposite backgrounds, opposite views on where to take the ecclesia, both in positions of leadership and one having to instruct the other in terms of taking over from as basically the head of the ecclesia. And after 10 years, and I don't think those 10 years were altogether the loveliest years, certainly in the initial stages, there would have been a lot of difficulty. A lot of pouting and carrying on, perhaps. But it didn't take too long before the lights went on for both of them. And they were like that. And they loved each other. It can happen in your ecclesia too. But it takes effort. But when you work together as a team, brethren and sisters, rather than trying to oppose each other, wow, stand back. Because you can do marvellous things. And marvellous things were happening within the ecclesia of God in that 10-year period. Now, let's just talk about this. Israel, across those 10 years, had fallen back. She was still halting between two opinions. Ahab reigned for 3 years after the incident concerning Naboth and his vineyard. We know that from 1 Kings chapter 22, verses 1 and 2. And then his son, Ahaziah, reigned for 2 years. And he was a weak and faithless king. And Moab rebelled. We'll talk about that, God willing, this evening. Moab rebelled, and they had an economic crisis within Israel. And then after Ahaziah was king for only 2 years, then another son of Ahab came to the throne, and his name was Jehoram. We'll speak about Jehoram tonight, won't say too much more about him, but they were all pretty ordinary, brethren and sisters. They weren't much chop at all. Not leaders, politicians. And it really was an underground. Jezebel's still alive. Jezebel's still there. It was an underground ecclesia. But brethren and sisters, it was forming up into some strength, cohesion, unity, harmony. Beautiful. But, brethren and sisters, it was really tough. Baal worship was still alive and well. And not only Baal worship, but calf worship was alive and well. And the ecclesia of God found itself right up hard against in the same town where there was a vibrant ecclesia, there was vibrant calf worship. And they'd look across the river at each other and they'd hate each other. And it was a real tough situation. And the ecclesia, you know, they would have had bricks through their windows and all that sort of stuff. And the ecclesia would have been jostled and all that sort of stuff. And who was the glue? Who was holding this all together? Well, in the absolute sense, in the technical sense, brethren and sisters, of course it was Yahweh. Of course Yahweh was protecting the ecclesia of God. Look, that goes without saying. I'm not trying to resist that thought. But in a visual sense, who was there as the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof? Well, it was Elijah. You don't mix it with Elijah without knowing what you're doing. He was a pretty tough customer. And the calf worship people and the Baal worship people and Jezebel and anyone else knew, all right, that guy's got a bit of strength. We'll just keep our distance. He is the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Now, as much as it might be a wonderful exposition, and I've seen some very good expositions on this thing, brethren and sisters, I'm not going to go into any detail about Ezekiel's prophecy or anything like that and explain the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof. That's for another occasion, another situation. Just think what it means in its basics. That's your insurance policy. When things go wrong, there's always Elijah. See the point? Oh yes, there is some, he's not the easiest person necessarily to get along with, but no one will touch the ecclesia of God without realizing that this guy could really do some damage. So he was the military, the defense of Israel, the chariots of Israel, and all the horses that lead the chariots. See the point? So you feel a certain amount of security while you've got Elijah. Now, who's going to replace Elijah? Elisha? Unknown force. Don't know much about this fellow. Big overlap, and sure, there's cross-pollination. But how's it really going to... Look, the ecclesia can't afford to make too many mistakes here. I'll show you that in a moment. The ecclesia can't afford to have two left feet over this issue. It could really end up being a massacre the other way if God removes himself, even temporarily, from Israel. So when Elijah departs, the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof have left. And I don't feel too happy about that. And particularly if I was in one of those ecclesias that shared space with the apostasy, I'd be awfully worried because I now no longer have got my security blanket known as Elijah. And that was the issue of 2 Kings chapter 2. And there was an elephant in the room. We can't talk about it because, it's just too upsetting to talk about Elijah's departure, and heck, what's going to happen now? Okay, let's just give some background here. Look, 2 Kings chapter... Oh, we'll have to put this up a bit. 2 Kings chapter 2 can be summarised in terms of the movements... can be summarised with the red part. Okay? Gilgal was where there was an occlusion. Now, it's not that Gilgal, it's not the Gilgal that's down there towards Jericho. In fact, in Israel, I know, I mean, there could be plenty more. There's at least three Gilgals. So I've suggested that this is the Gilgal towards the centre there. There's another one way up the top there, and of course there's another one towards Jericho. Okay, I'm suggesting that this is the middle one because they say in 2 Kings 2 that they went from Gilgal down to Bethel. Now, if you were down on towards Jericho, towards the Dead Sea, you know, down to Bethel, you know, you're right down, well, it's below sea level, you know, Jericho and those places. It's a bit hard to imagine that you go down to Bethel from the Gilgal down here. So I'm suggesting that the Gilgal is that one that you see on the overhead. So they went from Gilgal, where there was an occlusion of God. It's thought perhaps even Elisha might have, at least temporarily, lived in Gilgal, to Bethel, where there was an occlusion of God, down to Jericho, then they cross the Jordan River, miraculously, and then Elijah is taken up in a whirlwind. Now, the green, look at the green there. This is a circuit that Samuel adopted in his day. He had the ecclesia at Gilgal, these are where the sons of the prophets were, Bethel, Mizpah, and his home at Ramathaim Zophim. So it looks like the remnants of that which was established in Samuel's day was reconstituted, or taken out of from underground, because that's where it was, taken out from underground, and they actually, you know, well, we can now start building ecclesial halls because, you know, there's always Elijah. Now Elijah will look after us. So something of that Samuel circuit was recreated, and you've got Gilgal, Bethel, and then, you know, down towards Jericho and across, and so on. Okay. So it says in 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 1, it came to pass when Yahweh would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Okay, so that's their starting point. And look what verse 2 says. And Elijah said to Elisha, tarry here, I pray thee, for Yahweh hath sent me to the next ecclesia on our circuit. This could have been part of their normal circuit to Bethel. And Elisha says, interestingly, at the end of verse 2, he says to Elijah, as Yahweh lives, and as thy soul lives, I will not leave thee. There's an elephant in the room. Elijah knew not to ask why. Because out would come the fact, Elisha would say, Elijah, you're leaving me today. I can't handle that. I'm scared. I'm taking over. Look, if I could, I'd hold on to you for the rest of my life. I'm going to hold on to you till I can hold on no longer. Don't ask me to stay at Gilgal. And they don't discuss it. See the elephant? Now, what I suspect happens, brothers and sisters, when Elijah, any other day, in that 10-year period, would be in Gilgal, the ecclesia there, he'd say to Elisha, look, Elisha, there's a few issues here in Gilgal that we've got to sort out. Look, I'll leave it to you. Look, I'll meet you down in Bethel in a few days' time, but you stay here and just sort out this particular issue. Is that okay? Yeah, that's fine. Okay. And we'll meet 3 days from now in the ecclesial hall at Bethel. Is that fine? Yeah, right. Away we go. And then if you were at Bethel and you went down to Jericho or one of those other places, where, you know, they would normally, and it'd be just like, you know, talking about the weather and, you know, oh, and pass the tomato sauce, would you? You know, something as nondescript as that. But this wasn't that. You stay in Gilgal and I'll just go to Bethel. And Elisha says, oh, no, No, not this time. Sorry. As Yahweh lives, and as thy soul lives, I ain't leaving. So away they go, and they come down to Bethel. And the sons of the prophets that were at Bethel came forth to Elisha and said unto him, hey, took him aside. Hey, don't you know? Are you the only one who doesn't know? Elijah's leaving today. Now, the elephant in the room, only now it's being whispered, don't you know? Yeah, of course I know. In fact, at the end of verse 3, Elisha says, yes, I know it. Shush! That's what the Hebrew says. I can't discuss this. It's too upsetting. Shush! So, away they go. And Elijah says in verse 4 to him, they're at Bethel now, Elisha, tarry here, I pray thee. You know, Yahweh hath sent me to the ecclesia at Jericho. Inference. Just like before, and we'll join up another day. But no, it wasn't that at all. He knew what it was about. Elisha was no dope. And he said, as Yahweh lives and as thy soul lives, I'll not leave thee. So they came to Jericho. And the sons of the prophets that were at Jericho came to Elisha and said exactly, hey, don't you know? He's going today. The same response. Shush! Of course I know. And Elijah said unto him at Jericho, verse 6, tarry, I pray thee, here, for Yahweh hath sent me to Jordan. And again, the same response. As Yahweh liveth and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. And they too went on. Now, it's crunch time. This is where it happens. Verse 7, binoculars in hand. 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood to view afar off. They knew something dramatic was about to take place, and Elijah and Elisha stood by Jordan. Now, look at verse 8. Elijah took his mantle. Now, that symbolises his office. He took his mantle, took off his coat, okay? Wrapped it together, smote the waters, and they were divided hither and thither so that they too went over on dry ground. Now, this is Red Sea revisited. Crossing of the Jordan revisited. What were those events meant to do so many years previous? To give you courage. You know, when you're crossing the Jordan into this land which is, you know, walled up to heaven and all that sort of stuff, what do you want? You want reassurance. Is God really with us? Or are we going to get massacred? You want reassurance. When you're crossing the Red Sea, there was a huge song presented about the crossing of the Red Sea. What did you want? You wanted reassurance that you really, the Egyptians were dead and you'd at last got rid of them. Reassurance. Why do I say that, brethren and sisters? Well, do you think this is the first time anyone ever crossed the Jordan? Of course they did it every day. They had boats. They had ferries. They had canoes. You just pay the ferryman. All you do, put your car on the thing and away you go. You do that every day. So why in verse 8 should it be any different? Do you think Elijah did this every other day when he crossed the Jordan? Of course he didn't. This was to strike fear in the enemies of God and to strike courage in the ecclesia of God. And Elijah took his mantle and wrapped it together and smote the waters, and they were divided hither and thither, so that they too went over on dry ground. Came to pass when they were gone over that the elephant in the room was now discussed. At last. Okay, says Elijah. What is it? Ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee. Okay, out with it. And Elisha said, he didn't say this, brethren and sisters, but I'll put some words that aren't there, but I think are there. Elijah, I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm not you. Oh, I've learnt a lot. Thank you. And if you've learnt something from me, I'm delighted. But I got to go back alone. Could you give me double of what you've got? The Spirit of God. Because I don't think I can handle it any other way. That's what he says. Let a double portion of thy Spirit be upon me. And Elijah says, well, look, you've asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I'm taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee, but if not, it shall not be so. In other words, if you really believe that, if you really are committed to what you're saying, you'll have to stick with me right to the very end as a sign of your commitment. And that's exactly what he did. And verse 11, and you know, these are one of those things, I don't know about you, brethren and sisters, but there are occasional verse 11s that pop up throughout Scripture, and you really wish that there was verse 11 A, B and C. What on earth did they talk about? Look at verse 11. It came to pass, as they still went on and talked, that this, that and the other happened. But they went on, and that last red arrow, see? And they're walking along. Now, the elephant is being discussed. There's no niceties now. There's no choreography around an issue and dancing and carrying on. It's all out in the open. Now, Elijah's about to leave. He knows he's handing over something, not horrible, but a really difficult task to Elisha. And he says, all right, Elijah, look, these are the last words I'm ever going to say to you. Here's some advice. Oh, brethren and sisters, I wish it was written down. I just wish we knew what he said and how the conversation... It wouldn't be, you know, trivial stuff, you know, put the cat out and feed the dog. It wasn't any of that stuff. This would have been the essence of the future. And, oh, we would have loved that exhortation, but we're not given it. But I presume he would have talked about the future, because literally in the Hebrew it says they were walking and walking and talking and talking, and it would have been, you know, a little bit urgent now. And then as they were engaged in that discussion, behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire and parted them both asunder. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. And look at verse 12. Here's Elisha emotional now. Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. Now, there are two brethren who 10 years ago, I reckon, if you were in an ecclesial situation like this, Elijah would be down there and Elisha would be there, and they wouldn't have much in common, wouldn't talk to each other, and when they do, they'd say, he's an odd bod. Here he says, my father. That's how he viewed him. I mean, he disowned his previous life. Goodbye, mum and dad. I got a new dad. It's Elijah. And he's absolutely swept up in the emotion of the situation. And he cries in verse 12, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And he saw him no more. And he took hold of his own clothes and he tore them in two bits. I feel for Elisha, brothers and sisters. You know, how could you have to be made of wood not to feel for him right now? Tore his coat in two bits. In verse 13, he took up also, now this is interesting, the mantle of Elijah. That symbolised his office. Okay? That he was a prophet. Now here's a man who's going to be prophet in Elijah's room. In other words, his replacement. So he picks up, symbolically, picks up this mantle. So the only thing he's got of Elijah left, he picks it up in verse 13 that fell from him. And he went back and he stood by the bank of Jordan. Now, brethren and sisters, look, forget everything else, but don't forget this. This is just so moving. Verse 14 and 15. Look, what do you think would have... Let me paint the opposite situation. What do you think the effect on the ecclesia of God... They've got binoculars out, right? They don't know what's happened. They've never seen it. It was miraculously done. They didn't see Elijah go by will into heaven. They saw two men toddle off and one man toddle back with the mantle. That's all they saw. And when those two men toddled off initially, brethren and sisters, how did they do it? Well, when he left Israel, he broke Jordan in half. What a powerful demonstration. God is with you, Israel. Just hang in there. Now, you imagine this one man comes back with Elijah's mantle. Imagine, hello, Israel. Has anyone got a canoe? I need to cross the Jordan. A dollar for the ferry trip? Is that what it costs to get across the Jordan? Where's the ferryman? I'll just have to be... I'll wait. How would you feel? Come on. Oh, so he's going to fill the boots of Elijah? This little weed of a guy? Is this our leader? Oh no, we're doomed. He politely waits for the ferryman to come. Oh no. What does he do? Have a look at verse 14. Now, Elisha asks the only question that makes any relevance whatsoever. This is the elephant, only it's got fatter. What was the only question that made any sense to the sons of the prophets? Elijah's gone. Has the God of Elijah gone too? Where, says Elisha, here he is, he's on that side Jordan. He yells it out. Where is Yahweh, God of Elijah? That was the question in their minds. And he yells it out back to them. Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? And he picks up the mantle and breaks Jordan in half again. You don't need words, brethren and sisters. Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? He's with Elisha. And back triumphantly, and I don't mean that in a fleshly sense, but triumphantly, with binoculars and everyone looking on, the whole bit. Where is Yahweh, the God of Elijah? And there's the man, proving that the chariots of Israel and the horsemen thereof haven't departed with Elijah. They're right there with Elisha. We're really not doomed at all. And brethren and sisters, you might say, oh, that's obvious and that's simple and, you know, is that all you got to say? Oh, come on. Look, you try and be one of those sons of the prophets. Really? I mean, we've got an ecclesia in crisis here, brothers and sisters, in this record. I'll show it to you in a minute. I'll show it to you. And so it says in verse 16, and they said unto him, behold now, there be with thy, hold on, servants, 50 strong men, let them go, we pray thee, and seek thy master. So the 50 sons of the prophets say, look, we know what you're saying, but can we go and look for Elijah? And he says, look, forget it. It's not relevant. He's gone. And they pecked at him. That's what the Hebrew says. They pecked at him. You know how children peck at you? Well, they pecked at Elisha. Look, we need closure in our mind. But look, the bit that I like is the beginning of verse 16. Behold now, they say, the delegation comes up, behold now, there be with thy servants. The sons of the prophets put themselves in the role of servants to Elisha. Now that's significant. They've accepted that Elijah has got the mantle of Elijah and he now can carry forward the work. Anyway, they pecked at him in verse 17 and anyway, he says, all right, well look, you've got to get closure to this. You go and find out where Elijah is, and they realise that he's gone, and they came back, and verse 18, when they came again to him, for he tarried at Jericho, he said to them, look, did I not say unto you, go not? In other words, okay, you needed that closure perhaps, but look, let's get on with the future. Let's get on with tomorrow. And then we come to two incidents. And they are very different incidents. One was in Jericho and the other one was at Bethel. Now, this is interesting, brothers and sisters. Jericho was the head of a prosperous and large valley. It was something of an oasis of sorts. In fact, so I'm told, and those of you who've been to Israel could tell me more than I could tell you, I'm told that it possessed the largest spring in Israel and it watered the entire valley and made it look beautifully green. There was just one problem. The spring was corrupt and it caused the fruit to fall off the tree and it caused the progeny of the livestock to miscarry. Or that the progeny was miscarried, I should say. So what's the good of that? In fact, humans miscarried as well. There was something in the water. So for all its potential, you know, it was useless. See the point? And so in verse 19, the men of the city, we call them, what do we call them these days? We used to call them aldermen. What do we call them now? Councillors or something. Local councillors or something like that. The men of the city said to Elisha, so here he is, he's come back and he's established as the head of the ecclesia, replacing Elijah. And then you've got a delegation of aldermen from Jericho and they come up to Elisha and they say, listen, Elisha, I pray thee, look how nice it is the way they come. Behold, I pray thee, the situation of the city is pleasant, as my Lord can easily see. But look, the water is naught and the ground is barren. It causes to miscarry. In other words, it's an economic burden upon us. Now, why was that? Well, Jericho was cursed in Joshua's day. All the goods of Jericho were cursed. That was the whole problem with Achan. And it says, just turn back to 1 Kings chapter 16... It says in verse 34, in Ahab's days, so the earlier days presumably, did Hiel the Bethelite build Jericho. Now, these words are very pregnant. Hiel rebuilt Jericho, the cursed city. Okay? And there was a curse to be placed upon the person who rebuilt Jericho. It was to be a symbol of the way God felt about the Canaanites. It's cursed. Let it go. Don't rebuild it. And in Ahab's day, this idiot known as Hiel said, I'll rebuild Jericho. Do you think he did it on his own? I'll tell you who I think had a word in that. I reckon Jezebel put him up to it. Almost as an act of defiance. That city's cursed by God. Hiel, go and rebuild it. We'll show who's really boss around here. So Hiel, now listen, why do we know that it's a Bethelite? What? So what? I mean, suppose he was from Gilgal or any other place on earth. Who cares? Why is it so important that we learn that he's from Bethel? Well, brethren and sisters, there's a very good reason. Bethel, as we're going to see in a moment, was a divided city. You've got the ecclesia, we've got on the overhead there, and you've got the calf worship that Jeroboam set up so many years ago that was alive and well. It was a split town. Okay, so the ecclesia of God is growing in size and its influence, thanks be to God through Elijah. And you've got these Bethelites who hate the ecclesia of God, who do anything to flout the laws and the commands of God. And Hiel, the Bethelite, who was attached to the calf worship, which was centred in Bethel, says, yes, Jezebel, I'll gladly do that, and I'll rub it into the ecclesia of God in Bethel. So it's awfully symbolic what's happening here, and it's centred upon Bethel. We'll get to that in a moment. But then it says in verse 19, very nicely, they say, look, the water is naught and the ground is barren. And in verse 20, he says, okay, bring me a new cruse and put salt therein. And they brought it to him. And he went forth under the spring of the waters and cast the salt in there and said, thus saith Yahweh, I have healed these waters. There shall not be from thence any more death or barren land. So the waters of Jericho were healed unto this day according to the saying of Elisha which he spoke. Now, let's unbolt this. This seems, why mention it? Big deal. First point, and I don't want to be too hard here because maybe it's stale information. The alderman of the city couldn't approach Elijah. And this is a long-standing problem. Elijah, for all his makeover, shall we say, still had a reputation as being a little bit inaccessible. But Elisha, no, he was a bit more accessible. So they wait till Elijah is gone, and then the first thing that as he enters back into the land of Israel, the first thing is this delegation comes out and says, oh, and incidentally, Elisha, could you give us a hand? We've got a problem with the city. Okay. Then they're told, bring me a new cruse and put salt therein that we're going to go to the head of the spring and pour from that new cruse the salt into the water to heal it. Okay? Nothing terribly difficult to understand there. Here's the point. It had to be a new cruse. A cruse, incidentally, is like a bowl. It had to be a new one. Not your chipped one. Not the one that's been through the dishwasher 34,000 times. Had to be a new one. Okay? The word cruse is a special word in the Hebrew and it only ever occurs here. And it suggests that it's a form of pottery that was unique to Jericho. It's like, I can't remember the name, but what's that town in England that's known for its porcelain? What is it? Sheffield, or one of those. You know, and you think, oh yes, you know, that's synonymous with this upmarket pottery. Well, Jericho was famous for its pottery. And it had a specially designed signature piece of pottery that Elisha says, you go and get that. And not just any old one that you've got out of the kiln that's sort of broken or that you've used 10 times. Go and get a new one. Refire your kiln. Make your best cruse that is uniquely you. Uniquely you. Fill it up with salt, and we're going to go up to the top of the spring where it bubbles out of the earth, and we're going to pour your bowl full of salt and pour it in. Now, suppose they had have said, oh, cut it out. Hey, listen. You know, we come here and we're very nice and pleasant, and you're going to make us look a real laughing stock. No, thank you. Don't you realise we're the aldermen of the town? We've been elected and all that sort of thing. We're not going to be made fun of in front of the rest of the town. Nah, forget it. What would have happened? Nothing. Naught. Zero. That's what would have happened. The spring would have just been the way it has, miscarrying with fruit and animals and humans. Okay? They had to extend outside themselves and say, well, we believe this guy is got the spirit and power of Elijah. We need to, you know, if he says stand on your head and walk 10 times, then if that's what has to be done, we'll do it. Takes a bit of humility, doesn't it? Okay, we're prepared to do that. So let's get our very best, our signature piece of pottery. We'll fill it up with salt and we'll go right up with Elisha and we'll pour it in there. And, you know, pouring salt, a bit of salt into this spring, well, that doesn't make sense. I mean, why would you put salt in the first place? And you only ever do it once, so even if it worked once, just, you know, doesn't sound right. You know, brothers and sisters, and we're going to talk about this again and again throughout the life. Well, we've only got tomorrow, but we'll mention it again tomorrow. Brothers and sisters, the work of God in Elisha's day and in our day is built on cooperation. If you want the relationship, if you want to define in one word the relationship that you have with your Heavenly Father, it's partnership. Now that's an invitation. We're not equals. I planted, Apollos watered. God did the thing that no scientist can understand. He brought about the photosynthetic action that was the increase. But get this. God did the biggest part. But if no one plants and no one waters, God is not going to act. It's cooperation. It's partnership. And you know what that means? Seriously? I hate this, by the way. I'm a coward. I'm not trying to sound modest. I was bailed up the other day in the tea room at work. I won't tell you exactly the circumstances, but they all know who I am. And I don't go around saying, I haven't got a t-shirt on which says, hey everybody, I'm a Christadelphian. But they know. I know that they all know. And somebody in the tea room, it was crowded, wanted to have a cheap shot at you twisted elfins. I thought, oh, thank you very much. You know, like, publicly, here we go. I had to keep my cool. And I felt uncomfortable. But brethren and sisters, God says, if I put you in that situation, you've got to stand and deliver. You know, he doesn't even ask all that much of us. A leaflet in the letterbox. How hard is that? How hard is that? Oh, but it's a hot day and, you know, there's a good movie on it, Noel. How hard is a leaflet in the letterbox? I know of brethren and sisters who've come into the truth where God has worked events in their ungodly life. And along comes a leaflet in their letterbox which says, oh, I might just go and apply for that leaflet, that booklet, or that lecture. I know of brethren and sisters who've done that. How difficult is it? You know, all your neighbours know, they're not thick, they know that you've got this funny ritual that probably, I don't know, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, in your glad rags, the whole family tumbles into the car and toddles off to their hall. They know who you are. And one day your neighbour might, you know, in an awkward sort of way, bring up this whole question of what you do on Sunday. You know what you ought to do? Take a whopping great deep breath, close your eyes, and say, well, we worship God at our hall and we're called Christadelphians. And if you get spat in the face, well, your master got spat and worse. But who knows, brethren and sisters, God might be doing something powerful in the lives of those people. They had to give that which was uniquely theirs and commit to what was being done by Elisha. And they had to do something, and it might have sounded illogical, but without that, brethren and sisters, there was no increase. Okay, now we're going to go to, we've only got a few minutes, unfortunately. I want to go to the last bit on Bethel. Verse 23. Elisha went up from thence. So let's go up. There's Jericho on the map, and he went up from Jericho to Bethel. So he's up from the Jordan Valley, he's going up the rise, up to the ecclesia at Bethel. Jericho was about 3,000 feet below. And it was the home of an ecclesia, as we know, from verse 3, and from 1 Kings 12 and a whole stack of other places, it was the centre of calf worship. It was on Judah's border, and it was put there for a reason, that it might prevent Israel from going down and worshipping God in Jerusalem. So it's on Judah's border, and there you've got Bethel, the divided city. The ecclesia on one side of the fence, the apostasy on the other, and there is this uneasy peace. This equilibrium. But it's very uneasy. And there's a lot of jostling at the edges, okay? Now, what's the biggest event that has taken place that might disrupt that equilibrium? Well, it's Elijah, and he's gone up. See the point? The apostasy knows that. Oh, did you know? Elijah's gone. There's this story going around that he went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Really? Wow. Now, any other logical people, brethren and sisters, any other sensible people, now, the world's full of 99.9% of them are illogical, you know. I'm not being too heroic there, that's just fact, I guess. But any other sort of fair-thinking person would say, Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind? Well, yeah, that's right. Well, maybe this mob that call themselves the Christadelphians are on the other side of Bethel, maybe they're right after all. I mean, that doesn't happen every day. And some talk about splitting the Jordan in half. Well, that doesn't happen every day. Oh, well, you know, maybe we'll take a pamphlet from the ecclesial hall, like they kept trying to foist themselves upon us. Well, forget all that. Just forget all that. This was an absolutely baked, rock-solid hatred for the ecclesia of God, and any amount of miracles ain't going to change them. You know, when Christ, you know, healed Lazarus, you know, he wept. Why? Because one comes out from the grave, and what did they plot to do? They plotted to kill him even more. That doesn't make sense. But their hatred was so baked in, brethren and sisters. Well, it's the same here. And they said, okay, Elijah's gone, and this little weedy guy is replacing him. Maybe we can overthrow the ecclesia of God, because he's not an Elijah. And look what happens in verse 23. And as he was going up, by the way, there came forth little children out of the city and mocked him and said to Elisha, go up, thou bald head. Go up, thou bald head. Now, some have suggested that that's the reason why it's thought that Elisha was prematurely bald. He was a young man, and, you know, they mocked his baldness. That may be true, by the way, and I'm not saying, you know, have it whichever way you like. But there is another way of looking at this verse. Bald head could be an expression of mocking, like saying a nincompoop or an empty head. You know, he's got no brains, bald head. See the point? And go up, you dope, is saying, we've heard Elijah's gone up and we've got rid of him. Listen here, dope. You go up too and we'll get rid of you. See the point? Not one to reflect upon what might have happened over on the other side of Jordan. No way. Now, in verse 24, he turned back. So here's Elisha going up. 42 little boys, so it says, come, and it would appear that they've ambushed him from behind because he turns back on them. So he's come up, he's got the city up here, and he turns back, and they're on the road with rocks, perhaps, ready to do some real damage to Elisha. Are these 42 little kindergarten kids? The word in the Hebrew is the word nayar. And the word nayar is well, it's like an elastic word. It doesn't mean nice little innocent children. I mean, for example, even in the world, you don't have 42 three-year-olds just running amok outside the city. There were bears and lions in those days. You know, it's the equivalent of me letting Brendan down the paddock where there's a snake. I mean, you just wouldn't do it. So it doesn't sound like these were nice little innocent little kids. If you want to believe that, that's fine. But I suggest these were roughly boys of about 14 or 15 years of age. They were louts. They were hoons. Because the word is very elastic. In fact, it's even used of Solomon when he got on the throne, the word nayar. And he wasn't a three-year-old. It's used of Joseph when he was 17 in Genesis 37. So he was a 17-year-old. So I'm just going to take... Okay, I reckon they were young to mid-teenagers. And I reckon, brethren and sisters, they were put up to this by mum and dad. How would they have known of themselves that Elijah had gone up to heaven? And they mocked him. And I think it was worse than mocking. I think they were about to kill him. Certainly they were about to do some injury, and I reckon Elisha's life was on the line. And it says in verse 24, there came forth two she-bears out of the wood and tare 42 children of them. And he went up from thence to Mount Carmel, and from thence he returned to Samaria. Now, why do that? Imagine life in Bethel that night. Now, in a city the size of Bethel, 42 teenagers lost their life in a day because they were shredded by two she-bears at the command of Elisha. The ecclesia and the apostasy, there was an uneasy sort of situation. Elijah had gone, and the apostasy wanted to overwhelm the ecclesia. Send out 42 louts to rough up or kill Elisha. 42 boys didn't come home that night, except in body bags. There were funerals all that week. There probably, brethren and sisters, wasn't one family that wasn't touched by this event in Bethel. I mean, the apostate part of Bethel. Maybe not in your family, but it might have been in your cousin's family or your brother's family or whatever. And you would have had impacted upon you the absolute fear of Elisha. Ah, he's just like Elijah. He's determined, and from our point of view, he's ruthless. Okay, brethren and sisters. Elisha then goes up to Carmel. Interestingly, he doesn't go to Gilgal. He goes from Bethel all the way, right up off the map here, to Carmel. Doesn't go to Gilgal. I think he was upset. I think he may have been just a little bit put out by what had taken place. He just wanted to go to his favourite retreat for meditation and prayer. And then he returns to in verse 25, and from thence he returned to Samaria to complete the work. Let's just close it there, brethren and sisters, simply by saying this. We face many enemies. They don't listen despite the evidence that we put before them. You have a chariot and you have the horsemen thereof. Be a little bit bold, be a little bit daring. Have your confidence in Yahweh, and he will direct events.